Hello and welcome to the first episode of the Women in Living History podcast. Today I would like to welcome Rachel, so thank you very much for joining me today. Rachel today is going to be talking about the Girl Scouts in the 1940s, a topic that is often not very seen very much within living history, and it's quite a niche area, so I thought for our first episode this would be a really good one to start with. So if you'd like to introduce yourself a little bit.
So hi, my name is Rachel. Poppy said I'm in New York. I'm actually in the New York time zone. I'm actually from southeastern Pennsylvania, just outside of Philadelphia. I'm in the southeast Philly suburbs. If you're from Pennsylvania, I am from Delaware County, better known as Delco. I've been a Girl Scout for, I'm going on 16 years this fall. And I actually run a museum called the Traveling Women's History Museum. The museum is actually my Girl Scout Gold Award. The Gold Award is the highest award a Girl Scout can earn. I'm also known as what's known as a trifecta recipient, which means I've earned the Girl Scout Bronze, Silver, and Gold Award. So those are the top three highest awards that you can get as a Girl Scout. I've earned all three. And the Women's History Museum was my Gold Award project. And I started that because I realized that women's history wasn't really being highlighted, anywhere from especially reenactments, because that's where I was seeing it. But even in museums and historical sites, nobody was really talking about the women. And if they were really talking about the domestic jobs that women were doing. And while that's interesting to a point, I know for a fact that women were doing a lot more than just, basic domestic jobs. They were doing plenty more than that. There was women in activism and, women even in male-dominated jobs, far back, So I wanted to really highlight the women whose stories weren't being highlighted. My museum covers 200 years worth of women's history. It starts off with the American Revolution. We go all the way up to women of today, but as far as a historical standpoint goes, we go back to the mid-1960s. We do have a whole special exhibit, though, on the Girl Scouts, which that is my pride and joy. That took me 5 years to completely build up to what I want. And it's still not even complete. I still have a couple more sections that I want to finish. But one of the things that I personally cover is I cover the Girl Scouts during World War II. Being a Girl Scout, it's obviously very near and dear to my heart. It's very, very important to me. But I also love World War II. It's one of my favorite eras of history. There's a lot of female empowerment, and it's one of the things that I really liked about the era. So I decided that I wanted to highlight the Girl Scouts during World War II because, to be honest, as a Girl Scout, I actually didn't know what we were doing during World War II. So I wanted to make sure that those stories were being told. A little background on the Girl Scouts, especially for my friends overseas who don't know what the Girl Scouts are. We were founded in 1912 by a woman named Juliette Gordon Low. She did temporarily live overseas in England, where she actually met Lord Robert Baden Powell and his sister, Olive Baden Powell. And she found out from Lord Baden Powell about the Boy Scouts and about how there were actually girls showing up to their jamborees saying that they wanted to be in the Boy Scouts, and they actually started calling themselves the Girl Scouts. And Juliet kind of took this idea along with Olive and ran with it. And Juliet founded the Girl Scouts in 1912 in Savannah, Georgia. Olive would go on to found the Girl Guides, which are our Girl Scout sisters overseas. So Girl Scouts only are in the U.S. Girl Guides are everywhere else in the world. Juliet founded us in 1912. A lot of things have changed, and a lot of things have stayed the same. The Gold Award being one of the things. It's changed names, but it's still there. That was one of the things that Juliet had. It was actually called the Golden Eaglet. But moving on to the main topic at hand, Girl Scouts during World War II. In America, there was obviously a really big shift as to what was going on as far as the culture. In the late 30s, early 40s, we're seeing, the Depression happening, and Girl Scouts were really vital during the Depression. The whole thing about being a Girl Scout, one of the biggest things is about service to others before yourself, putting others before yourself and serving others. So during the Depression, Girl Scouts were doing things like helping serve, soup in soup kitchens and making clothes for those in underserved communities, making sure that people had a place to rest their head. During the Depression. So people were really aware of what the Girl Scouts were doing. And when World War II really kicked off in the United States, there was instantly a call to service for everybody. Everybody hears about Pearl Harbor and how, the days following you know, people were enlisting in the military. You know, they were enlisting in the Army and the Navy and the Marines and, you know, then the Air Corps when the Air Corps started. And, you know, there was a really big call, you know, people started going to factories and, you know, everybody hears about that though. Everybody hears, what are the adults doing? But nobody talks about what these kids were doing. And Girl Scouts immediately, I believe it was 2 days following Pearl Harbor, I believe it was December 9th, sent a letter to the president, the CEO of Girl Scouts at the time, the president of Girl Scouts at the time, sent a letter to FDR saying that they were dedicating every single leader and volunteer and Girl Scout to the service of the nation. Whatever the country needed that the Girl Scouts could handle, they were going to be doing it. And they dedicated every single member, you know, from the little brownies, you know, who were in early elementary school, you know, so, you know, like 6 years old, all the way up to the adult leaders, you know, who are mothers and wives. So they dedicated themselves, you know, from the get-go. They were, whatever you need, we're here. And that's something that Girl Scout really embodies.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing because, of course, in the UK, we have the Girl Guides and we have similar organisations here in Europe. And, of course, when you think of the Girl Scouts, the American Girl Scouts, you think of cookies and sweet little girls and cute little dresses. But we don't really hear much of what the actual Girl Scouts do in America. Right. So maybe you could sort of explain that a bit more because we have this perfect image of this perfect little girl who knocks on doors and sells cookies.
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm not going to lie. Cookies is a deep thing in our tradition. That is something that's really, really deep. From 1912, you know, Girl Scouts wanted to find a way to, how can we fund our troops? How can we make money to do the things that we want to do, to pay for the tents, to pay for our uniforms? What are we going to do? And in the 1920s, cookie sales began. And actually, I'm very lucky. I live right, like I said, I live just outside of Philly. I can actually see the skyline from my house. And in Philly is actually where the first commercial bakery started making Girl Scout cookies. And Girl Scout cookies, a lot of people just think, oh my gosh, it's just a little girl trying to sell sweets to the local neighbor. But it's actually so much more than that. This is over 100 years of deep-rooted girl-led, you know, entrepreneurship. It is the largest girl-run business actually in the world. Because the girls do this, we make goals. You say, okay, well, you know, it's for, you know, American dollars per box. You know, we're going to get this much of that profit. You know, what are we going to do? If you sell 500 boxes, you're going to make this much money. You put it into your troop bank account. Well, what do you want to do with that money? Do you want to go and buy a new uniform? Do you want to go to Girl Scout camp? Do you want to take a trip to one of our WAG centers? And for those who don't know who WAGs is, it's the World Association of Girl Guides and Girl Scouts. And we have centers all over the world. Over in England, it is Pax Lodge. Down in Mexico, it's Air Cabana. Over in India, it's Sangam. There's plenty all over the world. I believe the one for the U.S. is officially the Edith Macy Center in New York, right outside of Girl Scout headquarters. You know, so girls decide, you know, what do we want to do? Do we want to travel overseas? Do we want to do this? And so that was, it's always been a very big thing. The uniforms, they've changed over the years. Mm-hmm. Right now, the standard uniform is a white polo shirt and khaki skirt or slacks or shorts, you know, depending on the weather, depending on your own style preference. Personally, for me, when I was a girl, I really loved the khaki pants. That was my thing, but I knew girls who wear the skorts, who wear skirts, you know. And then you would wear your tunic or your sash or your vest, depending on your level. Today we have a level called daisies. Daisies didn't start until the 1990s. They wear a blue tunic or a blue vest. We have brownies who wear a brown vest or sash. Juniors who wear a kind of this mint green, we call it Girl Scout green, sash or vest. And then cadets through ambassadors wear a tan vest or sash. And as an adult, Poppy, I know you can see my video, we wear navy blue.
Yeah.
So, you know, you kind of get this like perfect idea of what the Girl Scouts were doing. And that's, you know, we like to put ourselves in uniform. We like to make ourselves look really official, really important. And the cookies for us is entrepreneurship. But the thing that makes World War II really unique is that cookies actually stopped. You know, we gave it up because Girl Scouts realized instantly, hey, we're going to have to start rationing.
Yeah.
The second that ration orders came out, you know, Girl Scouts were like, hey, you know, flour and sugar is not going to be important to us, to our cookie sales anymore. That needs to go to our military, to our boys overseas, is really what they were saying. And, you know, so they ceased that. What they actually did in the meantime, some troops did find other ways to fundraise, but the national thing that came out from headquarters was they actually sold calendars and everything like that. Some girls did other ways they would fundraise. You know, they would sell flowers for Mother's Day, which we actually still do. Some local troops still do that. I know another local troop, they held like little dances and things like that, you know, and they would, you know, charge a ticket or whatever. And then the money would go towards that troop. Girl Scouts really, they kind of gave up the stereotypical kind of glamour, you know, look. And especially during the Great Depression and into World War II, they really got down and dirty hands. The 1930s, the uniform consisted of, for an intermediate girl, which is today's equivalent of a junior and cadet sort of level. So kind of mid-elementary school into middle school for us. So probably between the ages of about 10 years old up till about 15. And then they would become a senior Girl Scout once they were in high school, once they were into their teenage years. And the uniform at the time was a long sleeve dress with a little quarter zipper up in the front. Patches would go in the sleeves. And, you know, sometimes the girls would wear a hat, and then they would have a scarf, and the different color scarves would tell their level. They would yellow, green, yellow, and red would tell you what part, how many years they were in at that point in time. And they would also have a troop crest, which we still do. I have one, I believe, has a little lily on it. And also, you know, so when World War II came about, though, they realized, hey, we can't be putting metal zippers on these uniforms anymore. So the uniform changed. If you had that uniform and you were already wearing it, just keep it. Just keep reusing it. Some girls would actually take their own patches off of the uniforms. When World War II came about, though, they realized, hey, we can't be putting metal zippers on these uniforms anymore. So the uniform changed. If you had that uniform and you were already wearing it, just keep it. Just keep reusing it. Some girls would actually take their own patches off of the uniforms, and they would pass that uniform down to another girl. Just kind of keep reusing, which was something that was really big for the Girl Scouts at the time. The uniform ended up changing to very similar long sleeve dress with buttons all the way down at the front. They would have a little belt that would go with it, and then they would have a felt beret with the little Girl Scout logo on the front of it. Brownies, their uniforms have more or less stayed the same up until the 70s. It's just when they decided to change them again. It was a little brown dress with buttons up the front and the little iconic brownie beanie, which everybody kind of sees. If you look up, you know, vintage brownie Girl Scout uniforms, you'll probably see the beanies, which we still sell. We still wear. I had one as well. You know, and then the seniors, their uniform changed. It was originally this dark green dress that was a short sleeve, went down to the knee, had a long metal zipper bottom to top on it, and a white collar. And then they would have a little, I don't know how to describe it. It looks like a garrison cap. And during World War II, they decided to change that to a skirt and shirt set, which would have buttons on the side and then buttons up the front of the blouse. They would not put patches on their uniforms, unlike the intermediate girls. The older girls started really focusing on a lot of different things. Girl Scouts created different branches for the older girls to go off onto. There was the Mariner Scouts, the Wing Scouts, the Farm Aids, and then the Triple S. Mariners, as you can probably assume, they took to the sea, they took to the water. They actually had a completely different uniform. Their uniform was a blue. It looked like a little sailor's uniform. It was a blue dress with the little Dixie cap. They really focused on, you know, how to sail, how to tie knots. But as far as war effort goes, a lot of these girls in coastal communities, especially down in the Chesapeake, on the New Jersey shore, out in California and Florida, they were really curious, you know, how can we evacuate our towns by boat if we have to? You know, what are we going to do if we have to escape by water? How to look for submarines, enemy submarines, you know, or enemy ships on water. Which you don't think, you know, think of a teenage girl, 13.
No, definitely not. You assume you have, like, you know, your coastal artillery, and they're the ones that do the spotting and everything. You don't imagine sort of like a 12-year-old going, look, there's a submarine.
Yeah, and that was actually something that they trained to do. And a lot of people, like we said, like, they get this kind of Hollywood sort of image where these girls are just, you know, hi, would you like to buy a box of Girl Scout cookies, which I'm so guilty. I absolutely went door to door and did that. But, you know, go back to the 40s, and you had girls that were trained to know, what does a German submarine look like? And these girls had to be able to identify it, which is something crazy. I mean, you kind of were relying on a bunch of 12-year-olds and 13-year-olds to look out for your area. But I mean, that was really something that was important for the war effort. You know, the Farm Aid Scouts, they were kind of the Girl Scout equivalent of the Women's Land Army.
Yeah.
You know, clearly, you know, America, we lost a lot of farmers, and especially in the Midwest when the Dust Bowl was going on, you know, that area got absolutely devastated, and America really relied on the Midwest for a lot of crops. And now you lost your crops, and then you lost your farmers. You lost had the knowledge of this. And so the Girl Scouts, you know, they went out and they became farmers. You know, they were learning how to drive tractors and, you know, how to plant crops and plow fields and tend to farm animals. Continue to make sure that America had, you know, the food from farms. You know, they kind of became, like I said, they kind of became the little, basically a smaller version of the Women's Land Army.
Yeah.
The Wing Scouts, they focused on planes and everything. Their jobs, I think, is absolutely insane. As somebody who does, who's a Girl Scout leader now and a Girl Scout volunteer, and I have to fill out, you know, the insurance forms and, you know, the activity forms, I don't think Girl Scouts would absolutely allow this today. I think Girl Scouts would probably pass out if they found out, you know, that if my troop was doing this today. But the Wing Scouts would not only service planes, but they learned how to fly them.
That is quite impressive.
They became, you know, little wasps. And that was something that I found was just awesome. They would actually, you know, team up with you know, women in the military, so, you know, women in the wasps in the Air Corps. And they would learn, you know, how do we service these planes and how do you use them? And, you know, a lot of times, sometimes they would be bringing scrap metal into these bases, to these airports and everything to help make planes. And then they would go and get to do test flights. And I think Girl Scouts would have a cow.
Yes.
If they said, yeah, I'm going to go let my troop just go fly some planes. They'll be fine. You know, adventure and doing stuff like that has always been in Girl Scouts' blood, you know, with insurance. It's always really been in it. Julia Gridelot was actually well-known at one point prior to she passed away in the 1920s. She actually flew a plane over Girl Scout headquarters in New York and dropped pamphlets out of it and was like, join the Girl Scouts! So
it's quite impressive.
Yeah, I can't say I'm surprised that the adventure was in Girl Scouts to be like, yeah, we're going to go fly some planes. You know, I got to leave school and, yep, I'm going to go over to this base. I'm going to go. Go off on a plane.
But certainly what you see is a lot of these young girls going into jobs that, you know, you typically think, you know, Rosie the Riveter, who would be working in hours in a factory, or your wasps who were, you know, maintaining and flying aircraft. And you sort of think of these very young teenagers who, you know, have the guts to be able to say, I will go and fly this plane, or I will go and collect the metal. And, you know, I think it's quite impressive.
It absolutely is. I've been very fortunate that my council still has many older Girl Scouts, you know, alive and well, and I've been able to talk to them and be able to hear their stories about the time during the war, you know, what they really gave up, what they sacrificed. And, you know, a lot of people think, you know, with teenagers really don't care about what's going on in the world around them, what's really going on. And teenagers, the more I found, especially because I was studying teenagers in high school, being a reenactor, but being a teenager, I really, you know, I didn't want to be the 15-year-old that was going off into a WAC unit. It was going to look kind of, I knew for a fact that people were going to be like, that's a 15-year-old girl.
Yeah.
So I really dedicated myself to researching, what are teenagers doing? And a lot of people would come back and be like, nah, teenagers didn't care. Teenagers don't care now. You know, which I think teenagers
half of it is you didn't really have the whole teenage years thing yet. It wasn't really until you get to the 50s you start seeing. Yeah, exactly.
24, I think it was.
Is
the official year that the word teenager was invented. You know, these young junior people is what you were really seeing before that. And, you know, I would just hear all the time, you know, oh, my God, they don't care. And then I would research, what are my Girl Scouts doing? Especially because a lot of these girls were going into their teenagers. And then for myself, just being a teenager, they really care. They really dedicated themselves. And the girls who were in the Triple S, which was the Senior Service Scouts, you have to be a Senior Girl Scout to join. These girls went through agility training. They had to be cleared by a doctor to join.
Mm.
They became paramilitary. They had to know how to, you know, use signal flags, Morse code. You know, they had to be able to evacuate their town by boat, car, horse-drawn carriage, by foot, how to take care of children and the elderly, how to feed mass groups of people, where to shelter, how to identify where gas is. In a way, I can't say I'm surprised. Girl Scouts, you know, really becoming popular, really becoming established during the midst of World War I. You know, that was something that kind of stuck with them, is they really wanted to service with that. And so when World War II came about, I can't necessarily say I'm surprised that they wanted these girls to do these things, because they saw a lot of things. Well, what could we do? What could we have done better looking back on it? And so these girls, they really dedicated themselves, you know, even down to the little girls. They were, you know, collecting scrap metal, and they were going to USO dances to, you know, help support things. These girls were going and taking in, oh, well, Mrs. Johnson works over at, you know, the DuPont factory. She's going to be gone all day. I'm going to go help take care of her kids, you know, so that she can work. And so she doesn't have that. Girl Scouts really, end of the day, what they really came down to was they wanted to alleviate stress and alleviate jobs off of people. They really didn't want these people to end up with more and more jobs and more stress than what they needed. And so the Girl Scouts were just kind of there. You need me to cook for this group of 50 people? Okay. You need me to collect scrap metal? Okay. You want me to know how to service a plane? Okay. Like, and that was something that is even still very deeply rooted in Girl Scouts today, is we're kind of the ones there like, what do you need? What do you need? What do you need? You know, we can do it. We've got the skills to do it. You know, I have a shirt that says keep calm. I got a badge for that. And I honestly do. I have like a badge for some of the most obscure things, that I even, you know, with modern badges, I thought were kind of crazy. I got a badge on how to rescue a dog.
Yeah.
You know, rescue a frightened dog. And unfortunately living near the city and living near some not so fantastic areas, you know, that was actually a badge that came in handy, because there's that came loose and everything. And then I go back and I look even further back, and there's badges for how to identify where gas is. I'm like, okay, that's one that I don't have.
Yeah.
But these girls, they really had the skills to do it. And they really put their foot forward. And they really, Girl Scouts really pushed the boundaries. Integrated troops were already a thing. Unfortunately, in areas that were still heavy on Jim Crow laws, you know, a lot of those troops unfortunately didn't become integrated until, you know, even sometimes well into the 70s. But on areas where it really wasn't, you know, where Jim Crow laws really weren't heavily pushed, if pushed at all, these troops were some of them were already integrated. You know, Girl Scouts has always been very, very forward thinking with things like that. There has never, on the Girl Scout official end of things, you know, national level things, there has never been anything, you know, for segregation to cut people out, to not include people. Girl Scouts has always been, you know, inclusion and everything. But unfortunately, an area where girls really started getting excluded, and I gotta highlight this, is with Japanese internment camps in America.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the Japanese-American population, you know, in America were being sent to camps. However, Girl Scout troops actually became popular in internment camps, which sounds crazy, but in a way also doesn't sound so crazy, because it really brought this idea of light and service and something for young girls, you know, despite the fact that they were trapped behind these fences, something, you know, for them to do to help, you know, to help their neighbors and help their communities you know, within those things. And Boy Scout troops also became very popular at the time. And a lot of the troops would actually get, the Boy Scout and Girl Scout troops in the camps would actually get together and say, you know, everybody's kind of feeling down, you know, what can we do to help make people feel better? What can we do to make feel better? Unfortunately, after World War II, there was several cases where, you know, where people did not want to allow those of Japanese descent, and again, similar to the Jim Crow laws. It was very unfortunate, but Girl Scouts actually came out and kind of put their foot down and they're like, no, a Girl Scout is a sister. It doesn't matter what she looks like, what she wears, where she's from. She is your sister. You will treat her as such.
Mm.
And that was something that Girl Scouts really, really pushed. And it makes me, like, looking at it, I'm like, okay, like, that makes me feel, like, really good about being. Because I think a lot of people, you know, they don't want to recognize some of the bad things that happened within their own organization. And I'm happy to see that Girl Scouts has come out and said, like, hey, that should never have happened. We're going to make sure it doesn't happen again. You know, these girls, though, it's really insane. They really, really wanted to just, they dropped everything. You know, they dropped the idea of fundraising for themselves, fundraising for their own troops to, you know, what can I do for my community? What can I do for my country? Girls were going down to D.C. and sorting through, you know, mail, and they were helping, you know, get, you know, war bonds out and action booklets out and, you know, making sure that people knew how to use them and, you know, what to do. And I see a lot of the same things that the Girl Scouts were doing during World War II reflected in Girl Scouts in America today, with the coronavirus pandemic, you know, about a year ago that really started to kick off for us over here, especially in the East Coast. We saw some of the first cases where I'm at. And I see my own girls, I see reflected in those girls, in those Girl Scouts from World War II. You know, my girls, they dropped the idea, you know, cookie sales had just ended, and they dropped the idea of spending their money to go to camp, you know, even before camps were officially closed down, they just dropped the idea of it. Like, no, we're not going to do that. Let's take the money. Let's go to Joann Fabrics. Let's make masks for people. You know, let's educate people how to wash their hands. Let's distribute hand sanitizer. You know, let's distribute masks. Let's make sure that, you know, people who are homeless, who are on the street, you know, people who, you know, might not have access to these education and these hygiene products. Let's make sure that they have them. My own girls, you know, and we had to ration things around here. We had to ration everything from, you know, paper towels and toilet paper, you know, to be able to survive because people started, you know, it started getting out of hand over here. And my girls, you know, were talking to people here. So, you know, how to make sure that you're not using as much paper towels, you know, maybe use a rag instead. And, you know, let's, you know, instead of, you know, making sure how, you know, if you're using a disposable mask, make sure you throw it in the trash. And my own girls, they gave up their normalcy to help others. And I saw the same, I saw that reflected right back in all my, in the interviews that I had with women who were Girl Scouts during World War II. I saw the same thing. And it really, I think it really hit home for me as a Girl Scout, just to see that, you know, Girl Scouts, we've always cared. We're always ready to become this, you know, to be ready for service, to be ready for others and everything. And with going into a year now of the COVID-19 pandemic, you know, my girls are still persevering just as heavy as the girls did during World War II. You know, we might not, you know, be in the midst of, you know, an entire world war, but a very global thing. And to see my girls be ready to just be able to go off and do that, it makes me very happy to be a Girl Scout and to be able to see my own research reflected back. And I guess one time where I'm really happy history did repeat itself as far as the services Girl Scouts goes, where it repeated to see that, you know, Girl Scouts, you know, 70, 80 years later are still doing the same thing. They're still caring about their communities.
No, it's really interesting as well, because you certainly, you're right, you see a lot of these similarities between life in the 40s and, you know, stepping up to work on the home front and keeping the country going, essentially. And you're right, you see this happening again now all over the world, where you have these young girls who should not have this responsibility of the world on their shoulders, but they still do it anyway. And it's, for me, I mean, it's absolutely remarkable.
Yeah, I absolutely just love seeing it. And the research that I really steeped myself into to research the Girl Scouts during World War II, you know, because sometimes it can be very hard to find records and things like that. And really up until like the 50s, 60s, everything was just kind of based to the local councils, to the local troops even. So, you know, try to find something from national up until that point was kind of insane, because Girl Scouts National was like, oh, we kind of let them be free range for the first, you know, few decades. And on, you know, I was talking to somebody from National. She's like, yeah. She's like, had I lived back then, she's like, I might not have been, you know, as free range with the records and the history. She's like, because now I'm looking back on it and I wish that I had more histories that was more than just oral history, you know, from other Girl Scouts. So, you know, my research for this was really extensive. It was tracking down, you know, these people. You know, I would go to, you know, the history committee for my council, Girl Scouts of Eastern Pennsylvania, GSEP. And I'd be like, okay, do we have anybody that was a Girl Scout during World War II? I'm like, anybody here or anybody that we know of? And they'd all, you know, they're from the farthest part of the northeastern part of the state, and I'm all the way down in the bottom corner of the state. So they'd be tracking, you know, the entire side of the state, being like, okay, here's who we could find. And they'd be like, you want to give her a call? You want to give her a call? You want to give her a call? She's got this. She did that. She was a Mariner Scout. You're going to want to talk to her about this. She was a Girl Scout in Philly. She, you know, did this and everything. And so it turned into these massive interviews with people where it would go on and I'd be like, okay, what was your uniform? And, you know, what did your troop do? And, you know, what was it like? I just asking like these extensive amount of questions and all, and being able to track down and record that history is really important to me. And so what I've started to do on my own now is I started tracking down and recording what are my girls doing right now. So that sort of history, that service, doesn't get lost ever again. You know, and it's so also nice to be able to just track down, you know, some of the Girl Scouts who were, you know, who were girls during World War II. And
yeah,
like, hey, your great granddaughters, they're doing the same service, you know, to their area, to their country that you were doing in the 40s. And to be able to see their faces, to be like, they care, they still care, like that's still a thing. One of the first films that you see Girl Scouts in is a 1918 film. You can actually find it on YouTube. It's called The Golden Eaglet. And believe it or not, it was actually a silent film commercial that was meant to be put on prior to the film, which I think is something that's really cool because it in itself is about 20, 30 minutes long. And I think of it now when they told me, oh, that's a commercial. Like, it wasn't its own film. Like, it was a commercial to join the Girl Scouts. I'm like, if I had to sit through 30-minute commercials, I think I'd drive myself absolutely crazy. But the whole basis of the film is about these two girls. They see the Girl Scouts march through their town, and they're like, hey, who are you? And they're like, we're the Girl Scouts, and this is what we do. And they go through. They decide to become Girl Scouts. And what they end up doing is helping a family, you know, a mother and a daughter. And, you know, there's an infant in the film, you know. The daughter is really sick. The mother is trying to run her own household and everything, while the father is actually off to war. He's actually in the army during World War I. And they end up helping the whole family throughout, you know, the war and everything until he comes home. And he comes home. He's like, who are you guys? You weren't here when I left. And they're like, we're the Girl Scouts. And you can see the service that they were trying to do. And that was actual service that Girl Scouts were actually doing during the war. And you can see, you know, the other skills that they have, you know, during camping and cooking and, you know, being out in the wilderness and survival and things like that. But, you know, the one thing that really hits home is the Girl Scouts are always serving, always serving, always serving. And then you can flash forward to the Second World War and you see it again. And then just even push even further till today's Girl Scouts. And you can still see the same rooted values of it. Which is something that I absolutely love, is not only is it an organization that still exists today, but the fact that the idea of service, the value of service, you know, and just being a good person and trying to make one of our things is make the world a better place. And just consistently wanting to do that is just something that I absolutely love about being able to represent this era at reenactments. You know, I go to reenactments on the reenactment side of things, outside of the research side of things, you know, I do get the, are you selling cookies? And I'm like, I used to, because I'm an adult scout now. I don't do that anymore. But, you know, when I tell people all the time, when I talk to the public and I tell them, like, this is what the Girl Scouts were actually doing. Like, they weren't selling cookies. And I don't think, first of all, I don't think rationing hits people's mind that, yes, it also affected the Girl Scouts.
Well, yeah, I think there's a big misconception that there wasn't really any rationing in the US during the war. Whereas, I mean, from a historian's point of view, yes, we know there definitely was.
Right.
I mean, whilst it wasn't quite as bad as possibly things were in Europe, it was still quite serious, and you still had ration books and certain things that were incredibly restricted. And I think people have this like golden view of America during the war, like this beautiful prospering country that, you know, nothing's wrong and they're all sending their troops to war and all the women are sitting at home and baking. It's just like, yeah, no.
Right. There is such this glamorized Hollywood version of what America was during World War II. And I gotta that is, you know, heavily on the post-war, you know, American dream.
Yeah.
You know, there's a really famous picture from the Great Depression, even before World War II, and it's this mural on the side of a building. It's like the American dream, and there's this happy family, and then just below, it's a line to a soup kitchen, and these people look anything but what that is supposed to be, and all. But this glamorized Hollywood version of exactly what was going on in America. And how did it affect the everyday little people, you know, outside of, you know, your people who were in the Army and the Navy and working in the factories, which a lot of people, you know, not that it's not important to cover that, but, you know, people kind of just forget what happens to the person who's too old to serve, or the person who's too young to serve, the person who's still in school. You know, what happens in these tiny little towns? Because like, people were like, in New York City during World War II, which is great. New York City,
yeah.
There was a lot going on there. But, like, what was happening in East Jabip, Ohio, you know? Like,
yeah.
Nobody talks about that. And, you know, nobody talks about the rationing differences. You know, in cities, you're seeing, you know, much heavier rationing. Meanwhile, in the town with a population of 500, they're like, what's rationing?
Yeah.
You know, they don't really know because they're so isolated. But, you know, going back to, like, with the Girl Scouts, you know, people, I don't think they realize, like, hey, Girl Scouts actually had to stop their sales. And they willingly stop their sales as well. They weren't like, oh, we have to stop our sales because the government said so. They were like, hey, we're going to stop our sales before the government tells us we have to. And, you know, we're going to put ourselves first. We're still going to fundraise, but, you know, we're going to find different ways. We're going to become innovative. We're going to figure this out. We're going to work through this. And, you know, so every time I go to an event, you know, especially when I was still portraying a girl, you know, a girl level Girl Scout, you know, people are like, well, what about the cookie sales? I'm like, they didn't happen. And the look on people's faces, even the Girl Scout troops who come visit me and they're like, what happened to cookie sales? I'm like, they stopped. They didn't happen. People were like, you would have thought I told them, like, the sky was falling. They were like, what do you mean cookie sales didn't happen? I'm like, yes, I know. They lacked in a year of Thin Mints. You know, I'm so sorry. You know, they lacked in, you know, 5 years. They lost out on 5 years of Thin Mints. But, you know, you know, people just like, they get this, like this wide-eyed look. And I don't think it really hit them that rationing just didn't affect, you know, mom and pop sitting home. You know, it wasn't that mom couldn't make a birthday cake anymore. And it wasn't that, you know, supermarkets and everything were given this different look. It also affected, you know, schools. It affected, it affected young people just as much as it affected, you know, older people as well. Old. It really affected these young people, these kids, these teenagers, and you know how, you know, everything from their own fashion and their music and, you know, the things that they really cared about, you know, prior to the war, like what changed that. And for Girl Scouts, I mean, it changed their uniform, it changed their sales, it changed, you know, badges. The handbook is actually crazy. I have several handbooks. They're all 40s edition, you know, so they're for the whole decade of the 40s. But I have one that was printed in 1939, 1940. And then I have one that was printed in 42, 43. And then I have one that was printed in 48. And it's really funny. Everything changes. And when you get to the 42, 43, there's actually an extra section in there about rationing and about war gases. It's this whole extra insert. But then by 48, it's gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's crazy. And, you know, and to be able to see, you know, in the other editions of the book where they were like, hey, to cut back on this, you know, here's a modification of this program, of this recipe, of this, you know, badge, whatever, you know, here's how you can modify it. Here's how you can change that to fit the war effort. You know, like it changed everything. It shifted this whole big organization, this nationwide organization, and it rocked, you know, entirely, you know, how they were operating. And I don't think people really realize, you know, oh my gosh, it really changed this whole thing. And so when I sit there and I tell the public, hey, this is a uniform that was worn, you know, 2 years prior to this one. And people are like, but it looks so different. And I'm like, yeah, and here's why. And, you know, when I sit down and when I talk to the public about these skills that these girls put forth and these skills that these girls acquired during the World War II, during the war, to just try to help their communities, it's insane. People are like, oh my God, like they actually did that. And I'm like, yeah, they did. They really did. They went out and they trained and they were ready for a moment. And you also have to think, outside of Girl Scouts, much like today, girls also belong to other organizations, you know, so they were belonging to their own churches, their own other youth groups. You know, so you see girls who they were also part of, you know, the civil defense. And I actually, you know, I have a magazine that shows, you know, it's photos from Philadelphia during World War II. And there's these kids just sitting up in this tower and they're looking for enemy planes.
Mm.
There's actually a couple girls in that photo that are Girl Scouts.
Mm.
They were Girl Scouts. They actually belonged to local troops. But something they would do is they would leave school, they would go to a Girl Scout meeting, and then they would go and they would sit up in the tower, you know, with civil defense, and they would look for these planes. You know, so these kids, their lives, they completely shifted. They weren't even just, the girls weren't only just joining the Girl Scouts if they weren't in it already. You know, they were joining things like the Junior American Red Cross. They were joining their civil defense, you know, local community programs put forth by, you know, rec centers and communities and everything, you know, and church groups and things like that, you know. So these kids, their lives really became shifted into focusing on, like, what can we do? What can we do? What can we do? And I'm seeing a lot of the same things, like I said today, these parallels, you know, where kids are, you know, they have clubs at schools now to talk about, you know, wearing a mask and hand washing and how to prevent the spread of, you know, COVID-19 and, you know, how to support essential workers, you know, instead of supporting the military. Now they're talking, you know, how can we support, you know, people working in healthcare and people who are on the front lines of this, like first responders and, you know, people who are, you know, pharmacists, you know, people working in your local drugstore, you know, like how can we help these people? How can we support them? What can we do to make their lives easier? And, you know, so to see these parallels and everything, I think is insane. And it actually makes me wonder, once we get back to, you know, holding public reenactments and really being able to interact with the public again, it makes me kind of curious if I tell them, you know, about these things, are they going to see the parallels?
Yeah.
Very excited to see if people are going to see the parallels. If they do, that's going to make me even more excited. You know, because as a young person, you know, seeing, you know, a lot of things that teenagers do get swept under the rug, you know, it makes me happy when people like recognize the contributions of other young people, you know. And if you think their eyes get wide when I talk to them about the Girl Scouts, their eyes get even wider when I talk to them about the Girl Guides, you know, the girls overseas.
Yeah.
Or two. Because the Girl Guides, oh my God, they had it 10 times, you know, they 10 times crazier than what the girls in the U.S. did. You know, I read stories about girls who are in Girl Guides who they, you know, they might not have been leaving to go to Mariner Scouts to go learn how to sail a boat and look for enemy boats, but they were in resistance groups. Scouts were known to be messengers. They would often ride their, you know, Girl Scouts, Girl Guides would, you know, they'd ride their bikes and they would deliver messages to the resistance group because, you know, what enemy soldier is going to look and go, yeah, that Girl Guide, she's the one with the plans to kill us. Yeah. Like, you know, nobody's going to look at the, you know, the little 12-year-old on her bike in her uniform.
No.
You know, nobody's going to think about doing that. Then absolutely not. And there were girls who, they were going as far as, you know, helping people escape concentration camps. And, you know, they were hiding, you know, people who were Jewish in their homes, you know, and feeding them and, like, you know, taking care of these people. There were, you know, I see other girls, you know, there was a notable group of Girl Guides over in Poland. They were, you know, they were resistance and they were a Girl Guide troop, you know? You know, and in seeing, you know, the girls in England, you know, helping with, you know, evacuations during the Blitz and people, you know, down to the underground, you know, just trying to make sure that everybody stayed safe. They were still some of the last ones in.
Yeah,
you know, they were the ones that were really truly experiencing, like, the heavy physical effects of the war, you know, so whenever I talk to them, I'm like, yeah, they definitely had it, you know, a lot crazier, you know, overseas. But, you know, even just to still see the dedication that is still in girls today, decades later, is I think it's awesome. So,
yeah,
you know, that's one of the reasons why I absolutely love doing that impression, doing that, you know, talking about that. It's definitely a passion of mine.
Yeah.
Did we get any questions from Instagram at all? I don't know if we did or not.
I got two, one of which said, can't wait for this podcast.
That was me. That'd be me. Hi.
And another one asking what your inspiration was, which I think you've pretty much covered. So
yeah, the inspiration is just, you know, having been in the organization for so long, I absolutely love being a part of the Girl Scouts. And, you know, mm-hmm. I know some people, they didn't always have, I hear some stories sometimes where people like, you know, they might not have had the greatest troop or were not exposed to the greatest experiences. I think I got very fortunate. I'm in a very active council. My mother was my Girl Scout leader, so she was always like the first one to find out about things. And she'd always put it out to the other girls, you know, if they wanted to do it. But I was always like the first one because my mom would get the email, you know, 10 days before, you know, the release date of that event. Mm-hmm. My mom would be like, hey, guess what? You know, and I was actually very fortunate to be able to go through this. And then I was also very fortunate that, in 2012, when Girl Scouts celebrated 100 years, I got to be right up in the forefront of that. I was color guard for their 100th anniversary event. You know, I got to go to the WAGS meeting, you know, for the World Association. And I got to meet Girl Guides and Girl Scouts, you know, from all over the world. You know, I got to meet women from Nigeria who were Girl Guides. And oh my gosh, they were absolutely the sweetest. There was another woman, she was from Japan. You know, she got to talk to us about, you know, her experiences over in Japan, you know, with being in the Girl Guides. We had a woman from Scotland. She was absolutely amazing. She was an absolute hoot. I love talking to her. We had a couple came over from England. They were so, so sweet. I actually got to sit at lunch with them. We had Girl Guides from Australia. I know, but something that I ended up getting very fortunate is Princess Benedict of Denmark ended up coming. And she came over to us, this little council in Philadelphia, you know, in southeastern Pennsylvania, in this area that, like, if I said, you know, to anybody else in the U.S., like, oh, yeah, I'm from Aston, Pennsylvania, people would be like, okay, like they're like, I don't know where that is. And she came to this area. So at first I was like, oh my God, she actually knows we exist. But I got to be color guard for her at the ceremony. I got to be color guard for the flag of Denmark. But I got to eat dinner with a princess. I got to meet this woman and I got to talk to her about, you know, Girl Guides over in Denmark and this, the strength and resilience that girls have always shown. And for me, just being a women's history lover, like being able to see women, you know, as high up, you know, as Princess Benedict, and, you know, just be able to see that they still recognize, like, the strength and resilience that women have always had, is just, to me, that, like, really confirmed, like, my passion, because for the longest time, I always felt like people didn't want to hear what I had to say, especially with being in the living history community. You know, I felt like people just, like, they didn't care.
Yeah.
And I just remember I started in 2013 as a reenactor. And so I started bringing questions to the forefront about women, you know, like, well, weren't women doing more than that? Cause, you know, I started doing my own research as a young, I started really bringing questions to the forefront about, like, but what about this? What about that? Like, why aren't we talking about this? And when I would ever go to work at a historic site, you know, I'd be like, well, what are you guys doing for women's representation? And oftentimes they would end up sitting there. And they would look at me and they'd be like, we're not. And I'm like, okay, that's a problem. Like, women did exist here, correct? And they'll be like, yes. And I'm like, then why aren't you talking about them? Like, why aren't you talking about this? And so bringing the discussion to the forefront about women's history, about bringing, you know, what were women doing? What were women wearing? What were they, you know, what was their everyday like, you know, has been very important for me. And then to be able to find this kind of niche little area of women's history with the Girl Scouts, and more specifically with the Girl Scouts in World War II, has just been, like, awesome, because I'm like, I feel very fortunate that I'm kind of one of the people that got to really champion the discussion about what were Girl Scouts doing and what were young people doing. And just kind of, and also, you know, for the younger reenactors, you know, that I came up with that are still younger than me, or that are joining now, I I feel very fortunate to be one of the people that kind of gives them this little niche area. Like, yes, you people your age did exist, and they were doing something about it. And, you know, teenagers were in the front of the discussion about this. And so to be able to be somebody that kind of championed that, like, it's just been really awesome for me.
Well, thank you very, very much for coming on and talking about this. It is a fascinating subject. And I'm sure many other people would agree that it's remarkable to hear just how much these young women and these girls did during the war. So thank you very much.
Yes. For anybody who is interested, my museum, the Traveling Women's History Museum, is on Facebook under Traveling Women's History Museum. Our little pinned post at the top is actually our featured online exhibit, which is about the Girl Scouts during World War II and the Girl Guides. So it is a 10-minute little video presentation where I'm in the uniform. I show off some of the items that are in my collection and talk about, a little further and a little more detail about what were girls doing during World War II. So definitely check us out on Facebook and if that is something that definitely interests you. And I always accept messages on there, for people who have questions and all. So, if anybody has any interest in messaging me and asking more questions about it, or even just about women's history in general, not even just necessarily about the Girl Scouts, but, I'd be more than happy to go on there and answer questions for anybody who has it. But thank you so much for having me, Poppy. I really appreciate it.